Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, there used to be only two ways to meet for business, over the phone or in person. Now there's a better way. Use GoToMeeting to meet online. With GoToMeeting, everyone sees your computer desktop on their computer screen, so you get the best of both worlds. It's like meeting in person, but without wasting time and money traveling. And your conference calls will be more effective. The best part is that you can actually try it for free. That's right, GoToMeeting is free right now for 30 days. For this special offer, you must visit www.gotomeeting.com/podcast. That's gotomeeting.com/podcast for a free trial. Well, a very good day to you and welcome to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 174. It has been a wild week. Thanks for joining me. We're going to talk a little bit about that. My name is Andrew Horowitz. I am the host of this show. We bring on guests and experts to talk about the markets, interact with them, sometimes get in their face, sometimes we agree. But at the same time, what we're trying to do here on this show each and every week is bring to you, the listener, a little taste of what's going on the street and how we envision the economics, the world politics, and everything that's going on in between. And this week is no different. We have a great guest with us today, Satyajit Das, who is an old friend. He's been an old friend of the show. He wrote a book called Traders, Guns, and Money, The Knowns and Unknowns in the Dazzling World of Derivatives. He's going to be here today to talk about some things. I really wanted to get him on post the FinReg and in talking about the whole stress test of Europe. Perfect timing for all that to settle in and to have a conversation with him. We're also going to answer some questions with regard to the economics that we're seeing right now. What does that mean for stocks moving forward? And before that, we'll even start with some questions that I received from you. And if you do want to send me a question that you want to be answered, please do so. Ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. But before we start all of that, a quick favor I want to ask of you. Do me a favor. If you do enjoy this show and you get a little bit out of it, if you like the blog over at The Disciplined Investor, go over to iTunes and do me, not just a rating, do a review. Write a review on what you think of the show, because we do get emails from you, but that is one of the best places not only for us to see what you think about the show, but for others if they're thinking about joining in. And the truth of the matter is, the more listener base that we have, the better this whole community is, the better we have for questions and answers going back and forth, and it just makes a much better experience overall, spreading the news, of course, if you do like the show. If you don't like the show, well, do me a favor, don't leave a review. No, I'm kidding. Do whatever you do. Be truthful. Love to hear what you have to say. All right, so here we are. It is now in the throes of the summer, the doldrums of the summer, light volumes on the market. And what we're seeing is a general, I guess it's apathy. We're not seeing a lot of buyers step in, not a lot of sellers, not a lot of short covering or shorting. It's just this kind of like when it goes down, the market goes down. When it goes up, it goes up. But yet the volume has been, oh, just blah. Why is that? Well, it's the summer. It's also the trend we've seen since the March lows and even before that, where we saw just really lackluster volume overall. But at the same time, the movements, the volatility, the variation of returns have been accentuated. You notice that. No longer do you have these little bitty days up and down that kind of just cruise along. And if you do, you're always waiting for the next shoe to drop. No, no, no. What we have here is the constant agony of whether the stock market's going to be up or down 2% in any given day. And the problem that comes with that, as we saw the last 2 weeks in particular, if you recall about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago, there was that 2% up day on a Monday that just came out of absolutely nowhere. Stocks just went up like crazy, and there was a gigantic amount of short covering. Fear was in the markets from the shorter side. People wanted to hop on board, and then it just cruised along. And then lo and behold, we enter into this week where we have an up day, a down day, nothing major on Monday and Tuesday. Wednesday, the hammer hits. and the market just tanks about almost 3% on the S&P 500, about 4% or so on the small caps, followed up the next day, and then on Friday it was kind of this, I don't know, a nothing day. Just no ups and downs, a little bit up, a little bit down. We had some economics that came in. We had retail sales. The top line looked good, but a lot of that had to do with the energy prices and ex-auto. We also saw a report that came in with consumer confidence. The Michigan preliminary came in and actually looked a little better from last month, although it's still at a lower place than it should be. But that's because people are very concerned about what's going on around the world. We also saw inventories. Inventories, actually, there was a build, and that would be considered possibly a good thing. But the fact is, if you look at the inventory to sales ratio, so you look at inventories and you look at sales, so separate those two, you have growing inventories, and that may be good if you have growing sales, right? You want to make sure that the inventory is keeping up with sales. That's not what happened. Sales are actually coming down a bit, so the inventory is rising. That's not what you want to see. So overall, we're not seeing a dramatic benefit to the U.S. economy when we look at the economic numbers. Absolutely, we're seeing some good earnings come out. We're also seeing some really bad earnings come out. Look at what happened with Cisco last week. John Chambers came out and he said the horrible words that we said should never, we said this on the show, should never be said ever again, which is the same as Ben Bernanke said not too long ago, which was that there was an unusually uncertain outlook for the future. Now, wow. Again, markets don't like uncertainty, investors don't like uncertainty, but we don't like uncertainty when it comes from people like Ben Bernanke and when it comes from John Chambers, who has been a good and level-headed CEO and prognosticator of future activity. But what was so interesting about this, the numbers and the comments from Cisco was it flew in the face of many of the networkers and IT, as well as the electronics and some of the, and most, I guess I would say, technology stocks in general, about their good outlook. And that was something that really got people nervous about the markets. So if I could just make a suggestion or at least a request from all the people that will be announcing things in the future, if you could stay away from the words unusually uncertain, say something else. You know, hey, we have a hard time viewing the future. We're really not sure about what things are looking like. A few things have become a little bit choppy. Anything but unusually uncertain. That is just not words that anyone wants to hear. And I don't think it actually explains much because it's just telling us that you're totally confused and don't know what to do. Well, with that, the other thing I want to mention about the economics is that we saw that the German manufacturing number came out very good, and GDP was actually 1% in Germany ahead of expectations. How is that? Well, there's a few different reasons. One of them is a thesis that we're developing, and we're going to actually put this out soon, a full discussion about this. And maybe I'll talk about this with Das too, that when you have a low currency like we saw for the euro, the 118 and 120 back a few months ago, there could have been a lot of players out there worldwide looking to hop on the bandwagon to get a much lower cost for their goods. So they went out and they actually went and put forward orders into Germany, etc. Even Trichet was a little bit surprised when he saw some of the numbers over the last few weeks. So maybe this is a time to look at possibly shorting Europe. We'll get into that in a little while. Maybe not today, though. So let's get into some questions. Again, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. There's some great questions here. Let me just go right through this. This is from Anji Janot. It says, hey, Andrew, thanks for your podcast. I've been an active listener for a little bit more than a year and a half. I've been an intraday FX or Forex trader for the past couple of years. I'm at a level where I'm profitable consistently, and I would like to diversify my assets a bit with investing. I would like to know if you have any pointers on how to make the mental transition from intraday trading to more long-term investing. I'm pretty good at day trading, but I've noticed I can't apply the same techniques to investing with the same success. Can you recommend some tips on how to make the mental switch, et cetera? Again, thanks again. You know, my friend, that's a problem. Because once you get really locked into the intraday where you're just scalp trading and you're moving in and out on a quick momentum move, it's very, very difficult for you to watch any kind of losses, and even we'll say not even losses, but not non-movers, sideways movers in the market when you come to your other investments. One of the best things that you could do, this is not what I would usually recommend, but what you could do is just give up the ownership of the money that outside money that you look at when it comes to the longer term money, and maybe give it to a mutual fund manager or somebody who can manage it for you without your insight, and just look at the big package and big picture, manage your intraday day trading through your Forex and currency transactions on your own, and let somebody else do it, like a, again, a mutual fund or just a simple ETF. That may not be the best answer that you want to hear, but I got to tell you something. It is very tough, and I've seen a lot of players out there pull their hair out trying to make that basic switch between the two. Very, very difficult. Different animals altogether, apples and oranges. I hope that helps or doesn't really make you even more upset. This message is from Anthony Malizia. First, Andrew, thanks for being an object of honest source and market trading information without a hidden agenda. I've noticed often that the market reacts to certain information in an opposite direction and a fashion than an intelligent investor would expect. Oftentimes, I'd be looking to go short if I interpret the data news as negative, only to see the market do the opposite to make me hesitant to press a bearish bet the next day when the market seems to be melting down on no information except the prior day's negative news. I can't understand why the market didn't go down the day the info came out. Are the sellers just patiently waiting to see how the bulls react to the data? I interpreted the QED, where the Fed came out last week and said a few things, as leaving rates at zero for an extended part time as awful. Some reason the market reacted bullishly. I tried shorting near the top to make sure that this, and bottom line is I got out with some small profits. I sort of stayed. It's hard figuring this out. You know, Anthony, I know that was long. I want to read that because a lot of people have that same problem. It's not just you. A lot of the pros have the same problem these days. The market is doing what the market does, and you can't fight that point. I will tell you this, that the machines, the trading that goes on these days in the area of high-frequency trading and some of the trading that goes on at the big boys is meant to confound and confuse, truly. Because you think things should be a certain way and you put your money in, and whether it's short or long, and on a news item, and then it reverses on you. The problem is that you need to probably start thinking about a little bit of longer time horizon on the news. Now, maybe that doesn't mean a week, a year, or a month. Maybe, you know, 3 days. You would have been right on your QE move, with their quantitative easing move, and if you would have held it, but you got spooked out. That's a problem with investing. You need to subtract out the emotion when it comes to this kind of investing. Now, I mentioned Fausto Puglisi before. He's a great teacher of day trading. This is something that you may want to look at if you're going to be a good day trader, because day trading, investing, swing trading, and long-term playing, buy and holding, those are all different animals when it comes to investing. But each of them has their benefits. The thing is, trading the news is one of the hardest things to understand, because oftentimes when you're looking at the news, you're looking at the headlines. The headlines don't always match the actual news item. Again, take the retail sales of this week. Take the numbers that we see on the initial and continuing claims on a weekly basis. There was a while that continuing claims looked much better. Fact was, they weren't including the emergency and extended benefits. So if you're going to play the news, take a breath, because if the news is bad, it won't only react a short time, it will react for a longer period of time with some bouncing in between. Read the entire news item, make sure that you have the information that you understand, maybe check a friend or two to see what they think, and then move. Don't just take the market's initial move as the reaction. All right, last one is from Tom Warnicki. He says, I enjoyed my podcast. Thanks for producing it. Please help me understand how short sellers can drive a stock price down and profit from it. And he asks, a short seller can drive the price down as they sell through existing bids, but after they stop selling, the price will return to normal. It seems fairly certain that such strategy would contain high risk of covering at a higher price. And I think there are too many smart traders that would love to take advantage of a discounting price created by a short seller, of course. The only logical explanation I can think of is a short seller is trying to create fear and momentum to the downside that carries on so they can cover the shorts at an even lower price. And he goes on to a few different things. And he bought and sold a few things at low prices. You know, here's the thing, Tom. Of course, short sellers are either doing one of two things. They're reacting to the news and making a bet that the stock will go down. Or what they're doing is, yes, they are helping to press their bets to kind of push the stock down below a point where they know that stops will get popped and limits will get popped, and they can create a longer term downside trend. But don't forget, the buy side does the exact same thing. We all know certain numbers in the markets where those areas where shorts will just get blown out. Well, the buyers come in and try to do so and create momentum on the upside where they can actually get a very nice move beyond a certain point, whether it's a Fibonacci retracement point, a moving average, whatever it may be. So yes, that is true, but at the same time, over time, a stock, not from a 1 minute, 5 minute, 10 minute, but a stock will come back to its fair value, whatever that particular value is, and it will be rightly valued over time. So if you see an earnings announcement that we saw many months ago where Baidu came in, it was down like 30 points in a matter of, or maybe 60 points. It was 60 points in a matter of minutes after their news. The next day it was up. How do you explain that? Well, somebody was either reading the headline wrong, somebody got spooked, the traders came in, there was just no buyers that wanted to step in before they read the news right, whatever it was. So realize that short sellers and long buyers have the same incentive. They want to make money on their trade. So just don't look down on a short seller because they're looking to create fear because you may be on the other side. The same thing is true with the buyer. They're going to try to create fear also, fear to the short sellers. Big game, and in the end, there's always a winner and a loser on each of these deals on each of these sides. So hopefully that answers that question. Okay, so if you do have questions, like I said, ask Andrew at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. I enjoy answering these, and everybody gives me a lot of comments that they really enjoy the question and answer period. Children, it's a question and answer period. I enjoy it because it makes me do some research on some of these to give you the right answer, and I know hopefully that I'm educating you in an area that is very helpful to you. And you know, one of the things that I wanted to do, as I told you in the beginning of the show, was to bring on a good friend of mine that we haven't talked to in a while. His name is Satyajit Das. We're going to call him Das. And he has actually been on a couple of times before. And so many people have written in constantly that when is Das coming back? When is Das coming back? And finally, we were able to put it together. Lots going on in Das land in Australia. And I wanted to thank you for joining us today, Das. How are you?
It's my pleasure, and your pronunciation of my first name is getting first rate.
Yeah, it's getting. It's not there, but it's getting there. I'm trying. I know. I know you have a new book out, or actually a revised edition of Traders, Guns, and Money, The Knowns and Unknowns in the Dazzling World of Derivatives. And for those of you, I just want to mention something without embarrassing you. This is a finely written book. Das is just a terrific writer, not only on a technical basis, but the way that he wrote this book, weaving in the technical aspects of derivatives to a story and to actual real-life situations, names changed to protect the uninnocent, or to the guilty, I should say. But this is a great book, and I really recommend it. And this is really superb writing, my friend.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your kind words.
And I know how hard it is to write a book, by the way. So I could say that with some experience. So let's kind of dig down. There's so many things in that world of derivatives, and a lot of people, I think, that are listening to me say, what is it that, are derivatives going to be affecting me? What do I care about derivatives? Let me tell you, folks, derivatives are affecting you beyond measure at this point. Am I right?
I think you're absolutely right. I think one of the things that people forget is your 401ks are invested somewhere along the line. There's a derivative somewhere. There's also the banks that you put your money with. They have derivatives on their books. And more to the point, as we found out when AIG and Lehman's went bust, pretty much, that the world is extremely interconnected, mm-hmm. and that little line connecting everybody is that line with the big D, the derivatives. And right. That means everybody's affected, no matter where you are.
So now, when we look at the area of what was supposed to be the fix for this, which I think I've mentioned this several times with you before, because it just stands out to me that when we were supposed to stop the derivatives back in the days of Enron, it was supposed to be these things that you don't touch, you don't get near, and maybe about, 15 or 20 minutes passed and everybody was good about it, but then they went right back into it, right? We were supposed to fix it again with the financial reform regulation and bill, that this big overhaul that recently passed. What's your opinion? Did anything happen?
Look, I think it's one of the funniest things in the world. The first thing I noticed was when I went to the website to download the 2,300-odd pages, there was a warning that came up. And it came up and said that if you try to download this bill, your computer might cease to function. And I thought, oh my God, that's not a good sign. And then I downloaded it, and I started to read it, and I thought two things. One, this is word processors gone mad. Right. There's no longer legislators, there's word processors on Congress going right. through this. And the next thing, which was really very funny, was when I went through, I said, well, what have they decided? And the answer was, not a lot.
Right.
They sent off a memo to Gary Gensler at the CFTC, to the Fed, saying, you know, guys, we think these are things we'd like you to think about. And so what's going to happen is effectively that these guys are going to sit down and try to work their way through the detail. And the detail is going to be horrific because this is where the bank lobbyists and so forth will get involved. And also because the timetable is so deferred, because a lot of this won't cut in for years, by the time everything sort of works its way through the system, we'll end up with a lot of very well-paid and very wealthy lawyers who will have new houses in the Hamptons, but we won't have a lot of fundamental change.
This truly is, all kidding aside, and this is not just trying to be a couple of word quip about this, but this really is a lobbyist dream, this bill.
Well, I think, remember when the Energy Act came out, and I think John McCain came up with the famous line, the no lobbyists left behind bill.
Right.
And I think this is very similar, because, you know, boil it down. I mean, the essential thing they needed to cover was very few things, and they're not very hard. One is just focusing on derivatives. They had to focus on the size of the market. They had to decide, look, this market's too big. What do we do with it? The second thing they had to decide was, do we want people to be allowed to hedge? Or do we want to allow a free-for-all where people can go out and basically speculate? And you have to make those decisions. And also, why do we want, you know, basically these types of derivatives, which is the U.S. dollar, yen, big figure, stop with double barrier, with, you know, Elvis Presley sideburns and pelvic thrust. What the hell do we want that for? Why can't just a few forwards and options do? And so why don't we cut out a lot of the so-called innovation, which is just excessive, and basically make sure that we have simple products that everybody understands? So all of those things were really the key issues. They, to their credit, I don't want to be completely negative about them, they did try to deal with one of the issues, which is the risk that banks have to each other, which is a counterparty risk issue. But they then basically decided, you know, we like to pop pills. You know, they wanted a sort of little blue pill that they wanted to pop, and that was called the CCP, the Central Counterparty. So this is basically putting everything onto exchanges, except they haven't decided what to put on exchanges or how that's
going
to work.
This is the problem, Das. The problem is that this whole bill is a framework rather than legislation. It's legislation to create something, and that creating of something, it's essentially a lot of this is given powers to different divisions and branches, if you will, subcommittees, et cetera, to actually create something based on an idea rather than something concrete coming out. I think that's what the misinformation, the happiness that the administration has and that Congress has from passing this bill. You have to wonder, what is the happiness? It's really nothing more than, well, there is some, but there's a gigantic amount of holes in this thing.
Look, if you're a legislator, you don't get paid a lot, right? And the second thing is, what are you looking for? You're looking for your place in history.
Right.
And so, you know, you now have the Frank Dodd bill. The fact that it doesn't actually do anything is not going to be remembered.
Right.
The other thing which is fascinating is the actual, I suppose, regulatory turf wars. I mean, the most amazing thing about the CFTC, which has not shown a great deal of ability to control very much.
They're a little strange over there. They really are, seriously. Those guys, the guy... What's the guy with the blonde hair, the long blonde hair, and not Gensler, the other guy. He was the head of...
I'm not sure who you're talking about. But
anyway, he looks like a hippie. He's a little strange dude.
Well, I think they're all regulators. They're all very odd people. I occasionally hang around with them, and I basically walk away shaking my head usually. But the amazing thing is, he's going to go from something like 400 lawyers to 1,000 lawyers.
Wow.
I mean, you talked about lobbyists basically being very, very happy with the bill. I think, I'll tell you what, unemployment might be rampant in the United States, but there were no corporate lawyers going to be short of a job at the rate this is going.
Right.
And, you know, fundamentally, the problem here is that nobody really understands exactly what it is they're regulating. And, of course, the whole process has a huge problem, which is, you know, all these people will sit down for educational sessions with banks or with academics who are being paid by the banks. And so under those circumstances, the information flow and the knowledge base is kind of difficult. And then the banks will wheel out some amazing arguments, which is like, you know, the Chicago arguments of efficiency and innovation and all of those sorts of things. And in the end, they'll play the nuclear card, which is, look, if you do all of this, we won't lend money because we won't have enough capital to lend money. Mm-hmm. And the economy will go down the toilet hole. And then basically, everybody will go, oh my God. And then there's a last, really, that's... Now, the last one was the atom bomb. Then they have the hydrogen bomb.
Right.
The hydrogen bomb is, if you regulate too hard, well, all of us will go to Switzerland.
Yeah, right. Oh, it's amazing that let's just face the facts that the banks run everything. They have the lobbyists. They have the upper hand, no matter what legislation is written. Look at Goldman, which is, you know, talking about either going private with their prop trading or at least spinning off their prop trading. And, you know, they're trying to get around the Volcker rule already, which we knew would happen. And by the way, I thought it was really interesting how last quarter they lost $100 million on 3 days or more. It was almost like they were trying to show that they have some ability to lose money, to make us feel better.
I think that's absolutely right. I think it is quite funny. It's actually very similar to the European stress tests, when the stress tests, which were kind of a joke anyway.
Wasn't that terrible? That was worse than ours.
Oh, your test actually had some credibility. I mean, I disagreed with bits of it, but there was actually a genuine attempt to find out what nasty things these guys had in their closets. But in the end, the discussion in Europe became quite farcical, because you had regulators ringing up equity analysts around the world going, you know, if we have 91 banks we're testing, if we fail 7, will that be enough? Or do you want 10? And everybody sort of looking at each other going, sorry, why are you asking me this question? Aren't you doing an objective test? It's kind of crazy. But coming back to your point about the Orwellian world we live in, you remember the famous line from Animal Farm, which is, all are created equal, but the government and the financial sector are more equal than everyone else.
Right, exactly. Exactly. So let's kind of move into this discussion of the stress tests in Europe, because 9 out of 91 failed. A few of them we knew. The first one that came out was actually the Hypo Real Estate Bank, which was a nationalized bank, and they failed. And what I thought was really funny about that, first of all, is it seemed to set the stage for how this was going to go down. Because if this bank failed miserably, just absolutely miserably, nobody cared. Because it's a nationalized bank. Basically, the government can't come in and help it anymore. It is the government. So they put that out there first, that it failed, like as a kind of a little bait in the water, a little chum in the water to kind of see what happens. And nothing happened. And then the next few banks failed that we all knew were probably going to fail, and maybe a couple of others thrown in there for good measure. But one of the things that they did in the stress test were that they only used the trading book assets, and they didn't use the full book to mark down what would happen in the worst case scenario, right?
Absolutely. It's actually fascinating, that whole issue. Because as you know, banks have these two books, the banking or hold to maturity book and the trading or available for sale book. And they chose to apply the stress test, particularly on the sovereign debt holdings like the wonderful countries of Greece, Spain, Portugal, etc., only on the trading book. Now, that's actually fantastic. The only problem is that, number one, 90% of those securities are held in your banking book. That's the first problem, so you're not testing most of it. The second is, when you actually look at the test they applied, it was basically that they assumed that no sovereign would default. Now, this is like doing a car crash test, and the guy says, well, we'll assume cars can never crash. It's just absolutely crazy. And if you actually look at the markets are assuming that Greek debt is worth around about, say, 60 cents in the dollar. And if they actually have to restructure, if you look at places like Argentina, well, that 60 cents in the dollar is probably a little optimistic. So they did not test any of that. The second thing is, the definition of capital allowed them to count all sorts of what I call funky capital, which is really debt disguised as equity. And they had a lot of that, the European banks in particular, the German banks, have a lot of that. So they counted the wrong equity. The other thing which is absolutely, totally hilarious is, we all know that the European banking system is underwritten by the government. So to do the stress test at all is kind of meaningless.
Right.
We know what the two problems they have. One is, if you just take the French and the German banks, they're owed, wait for it, $1 trillion by Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Spain, Italy, and Eastern Europe.
Well, this whole thing was done for those two countries. And England. Is my understanding.
And England as well. And the other thing which is fascinating that the stress tests don't address is, this is really a liquidity problem. The Spanish banks, the Portuguese banks, the Greek banks can't fund. So the ECB has been actually funding these banks for some time. And they have massive amounts of loans out there. Now, those were the real issues, and how are we going to resolve that? Mm-hmm. But essentially, everything was sort of put under the carpet. Now, there's a nice little pile on the carpet, but we're all pretending it's not there.
Right.
And look, it'll play out over time. And to be very honest, the stress test is meaningless, because while you've got this 750 billion euro European Financial Stability Fund sitting there, we all know in the short run, if they can raise money for that fund, things will tick along. We haven't solved any problem, but the chance of an immediate collapse is sort of deferred for a bit. So the whole thing was kind of an exercise in public relations spin rather than actually really dealing with anything.
It's a confidence game. It is very much a confidence game.
But, you know, this is kind of strange when central banks sort of start to talk about confidence. You know, it's a bit like Jean-Claude Trichet came up during the early part of the crisis. He, in a press conference, said when everybody was sort of panicking, he said, "We must keep our composure." And basically, it was kind of interesting. I thought, a central banker telling you that he's going to keep his composure, you take that as a given. Central banks are not prone to panic, hopefully.
Right.
But, you know, it's kind of crazy. But I think it actually has a parallel, which was Emperor Hirohito at the end of the Second World War, after the two nuclear devices were exploded. He said, "The war situation has not developed to Japan's advantage."
Right, yeah. Underestimating the real issue there and trying to pave it over well. So the European stress test, though, now, and that $750 billion that's sitting there, and who knows how that's going to play out, it seems to me that there is this, there was a very swift, and let me get back up for one second before I say that. The stress tests, I think we could also say that the way they were done was saying there's going to be stress tests, we're having these stress tests, here's going to be the structure of the stress test. It's similar to going to someone who maybe that you want to do a drug testing on and giving them a 3-week advance notice and then cleaning up their act and taking things off the books and moving loans around and calling them things, just like was done here as well, but also allowing everybody to then do a reverse engineering of how it's going to play out.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it was even worse than that, because as you were pointing out with Hyperreal Bank in Germany, a lot of those problems, they could immediately say, well, the government's already taken charge or is in the process of injecting equity into that particular bank, so it's not really a problem.
Right.
And I think that was really the stage management. But what I find to be quite incredible is the markets actually bought that. And I think it's a case, I couldn't believe that.
Right,
Thinking there, looking at that, going, are you guys completely insane?
But that's what they wanted. That's what they wanted. They wanted to be able to just hang their hat on something. That's all it was.
Absolutely, and I think I have a phrase now for the modern era that we are living through. I call this the Botox economics, which is basically, let's just keep injecting this toxin into the skin, and it looks all fine. We know it's temporary. We know it has side effects, but we just don't want to believe that we're getting old.
Right, yeah, it's a combination of Botox and collagen, I think, depending on where you look at it. Exactly.
Well, I don't have any personal familiarity with either of those.
No, maybe
the combination works well.
Okay, so let's get back to the idea that Spain is back in trouble again. There's being some concerns there. We saw some economics come out that were a little bit soft this week, but and we saw Greek unemployment rise, which is no surprise to anybody. But what is going on with, do you believe, the recent rise in the quarterly? And I just want to touch on this briefly because we're writing a piece on this right now, and we've just kind of started getting into some of these numbers. But does it seem that there was a rush to possibly buy some of the goods from the European zone when the euro was down so low, and when they saw this $1 trillion backstop come in, all of a sudden there was panic in the streets, and the buyers came out and said, hey, you know what, go buy the materials now, you're never going to see the euro this cheap for a while?
I think you're absolutely correct. I think there were two dynamics going on, and I think the first part of the dynamics is exactly as you say, that euro was cheap. The other thing is, around the world, what we're seeing is, because of things like tax credits and just the sheer currency volatility, the timing of imports and exports is becoming very, very volatile. So what we're seeing is acceleration and deceleration, which is very, very hard to predict. And in part, this is going to be one of the key, I suppose, elements going forward. That's the first thing I would say. The second thing is, if you actually look at the game that's being played, it's the bigger thy neighbor game. Everybody says to me, why doesn't Germany withdraw from the euro?
Right.
And my first comment is, why would they want to? This is what keeps the euro weak and allows them to export like crazy. And if you're sitting there in Germany, you do a simple calculation like, okay, I have to throw some money at the Club Med countries. That's fine. But what do I benefit on the other side with a cheap euro? So in fact, everybody thinks that Germany wants to leave the euro. I see no reason why Germany actually wants to leave the euro. The second thing I would say is, I think fundamentally, we are now in a two-track economy in terms of certain spending. What we are seeing, as you know from the unemployment numbers, is that there's no employment growth pretty much around the world. But what there is people are retooling their businesses by basically trying to make them more efficient. I think if you're a smart business person, you're saying, look, my top line, my revenue will not grow a great deal, or maybe it'll even shrink. So what I need to do is get more efficient. So they're investing very heavily in technology, which is why we've seen the tech sector to be somewhat more resilient than other parts of the world. And also they're buying machine tools and so forth. And places like Germany are very, very good at those types of products. So we're going to see some uplift in places like Germany, to a lesser extent, Sweden and France and places like that. So we are seeing certain pockets of quite good news. But that's not going to last because you don't retool your factory every year.
Well, that's
the problem. Just do it once in a while.
There's the problem. We've talked about this. I call it consumption cannibalism. That's the name I put on this.
I think it's even worse than that. If you go back and you just back up from the temporary to the longer-term issue, mm-hmm. over 30, 40 years, what we've done is we've accelerated growth. Now, everybody says, well, we have a lot of debt. Why is that a problem? The problem is if you borrow and basically spend, you accelerate consumption.
Right.
It assumes you just can do that every year. And the answer is you can't do that. And if you look at that whole pattern, now we did it as individuals, companies are doing it, now governments are doing it. But the point is, at some point in time, a day of reckoning looms. And so we keep trying to kick this further and further down the road and hoping it's not going to be in our lifetime. Well, unfortunately, there is a point at which it catches up. And I think we're getting pretty close to that.
Pretty close. It could be another generation, but nonetheless, it's going to be a very big battle from here. A lot of this has to do with the currency situation that we've talked about. You know, we talk about the euro and the breakdown there and the dollar, how it's been moving dramatically, and the currency markets have been all over the place. Recently, the United States senators were forcing the card of China to release the peg that they had on for many years. Actually, they repegged back in, 2008, I believe, and to the dollar, to the U.S. dollar, which was good for them. That was a good idea, and I call it like a piggybacking move. It was very good for them, and it was good for the world, generally speaking. But what happened was that we wanted them to break that because we thought that that would boost their currency up, the yuan, and it would be great for us. They'd start buying everything. Well, they moved the peg, and they said, yes, it could float to a certain extent. And again, Geithner went over there kind of waving around this letter that was going to be released and exposed them as a currency manipulator. Oh, boy. Now, we're all upset about this. We, you know, this horrible thing about currency manipulation, all that. I don't understand why we never tried to do anything about Japan. Japan constantly goes in and does defending or some type of maneuvering on their on the yen if they have to. As a matter of fact, they're doing that recently. They're talking about this. There's some whispers coming out. There's leaks coming out. But they're involved in that. How come we're not calling them a manipulator?
Well, I think the whole issue of currencies is quite interesting because I think in the 1930s, you'll recall, we had trade wars. But what's happened is the world changed because during that period, remember, most currencies were on the gold standard. So it was pretty hard to manipulate.
Right.
Now, what we're seeing now is people just exactly as you say, try to artificially move their currencies to get trade advantages. And coming back to this whole issue, there's a really fascinating dynamic which just shows how hard it is to resolve. The first element of this is just let's look at the China-U.S. relationship. Okay, well, we allow the Chinese to basically, or force them to basically revalue the yuan or the renminbi. Now, the problem with that is then they're going to stop buying U.S. Treasuries.
Right. Silly.
Because essentially, if you look at them, they've got probably about $2.4 trillion of reserves. I would say roughly two-thirds at least of that is in dollars. So if they actually revalue that, they wipe out a huge amount of value.
I never understood that point. I thought that was the stupidest thing I ever heard of if they're going to try it. That was the first point. It didn't sink in too well why they would do something like that. But go ahead.
Well, they're not going to do it.
Right.
The second thing is, if you actually look at the parallel you drew with Japan and China is actually a very deep one. If you look at the history of Japan, Japan grew 10% in the 60s, 5% in the 1970s, 4% in the 1980s, and hasn't grown since. But the pivotal moment is you're identifying is actually a currency one, which is the 1985 Plaza Accord, when Volcker and the heads of the Japanese, German, and French central banks all got together. And basically they forced Japan to revalue the yen. And what that did was make Japan uncompetitive. So what the Japanese central bank did was then flood the system with money, and they created the mother of all commercial property bubbles, which collapsed in 1989.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what China is now doing, And China's developmental model, its business model, is exactly the same as Japan. Have an undervalued currency, export, have reserves, send the reserves overseas to help pay for the exports,
right,
and try to grow your country that way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Chinese aren't stupid. They looked at what happened in Japan. And they're going, if we revalue, well, we're going to have a fundamental collapse of the export industry, which is still very important to China. And also, we'll lose all our reserves. So why the hell would we want to do it?
Right, exactly.
And basically, so you have this debate going backwards and forwards. And I actually find these discussions between the U.S. political leaders and the Chinese political leaders quite bizarre. Neither understands what they're talking about, is the
right
first comment I would make.
Right.
Got a bunch of engineers who want to build big dams, which are the Chinese, versus corporate lawyers in the United States,
mm-hmm,
and economists, who have completely different agendas, trying to talk to each other, and not even in the same language. You know, so it's kind of interesting.
Right.
But then what happens is that each can't benefit to a large degree from the revaluation. For instance, if you actually revalue the yuan, one of the key things is it makes some of the actual effective earnings of the U.S. companies like McDonald's, like IBM, like Microsoft, which is basically from overseas, fall as well. So how does that help? Secondly,
right,
but if you look at many of the American industries, essentially you've taken the American industrial base, the manufacturing base, and shrunk it. So even if you have a cheaper currency, will that necessarily help you effectively export more? It certainly will, some. But will it do enough?
But it's with the assumption, though, that the manufacturing and all of the business is located in the U.S. rather than parceled around the world.
Exactly. And so all this stuff about the currencies that people are talking about is almost like assuming a world which existed 30 years ago when you had
right,
large
exactly
manufacturing bases,
yep, yep,
which doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, essentially, I laugh when the English basically say, well, a cheaper pound will help us. I'm saying, well, you don't make anything anymore, so
right,
what are you going to export?
Right. They just need to have enough money to buy a couple of pints and to have their day and a little bit of Marmite and a little bit of shepherd's pie, and they'll be fine.
Oh, my God, you're cruel to the lovely people from England.
Well, you really got the Vegemite down there in Australia.
Absolutely, we have Vegemite. We can't afford Marmite because the pound is so strong, so we have to get Vegemite.
Oh, I don't know. Any culture that eats that, I have to either respect or hate. I don't know which one. So,
well, let's put it this way. Your courage isn't in doubt.
All right, so let's talk about something that's going on new. Let's talk about these new structured notes that are coming under fire. Now, these are very wide-ranging types of instruments. I've seen some of these that, you know, I guess they could be a lot of things can fall into this kind of naming process where structured notes are what? They're maybe a privately created deal through JP or through Merrill, through whoever it is, and these are maybe linked to interest rates or they're linked to a stock market, certain situation. I've seen some bizarre ones that are linked to the stock market. If the stock market makes or gets to this point, maybe a 1,200 or between 1,200 and 1,300, you'll get this amount. If it goes under 1,100, you don't get anything. If it goes above 1,400, you don't get anything. Very strange looking rules. Every time I see that, we think derivatives, we think structured notes, we think problems. But this is more so looking at the environment that basically was like when we had the fallout a couple of years ago, right, of the well, explain what's happening. We had this big fallout with this
okay
before. It's happening all over again.
Well, firstly, mostly structured products are essentially derivatives.
Right.
So it's basically you buy a deposit or a bond, and then you overlay a derivative on top of it. And usually
right
what happens is you take the coupon, the interest you would have got, and you essentially buy options, or sometimes you actually sell options in these transactions, and they help you juice up your returns. Now, the background to all of that is many, many retail investors, if somebody mentioned the D word derivative, if they A, knew what it was, or B, had some familiarity, would be running like you were basically giving them a vial with the worst poison known to mankind.
Right.
So what it's done is very nicely packaged up as a bank deposit or a little note. So you think, oh, this is like a bond. This is like a corporate bond or a bank note. And that's the first thing. So it's a way of getting around derivatives regulations. That's the first issue. The second issue is what has happened, and we've seen this over the last 20, 25 years, is when interest rates go down close to zero, and as Mr. Bernanke has made clear, rates ain't going up anytime real soon, people are desperate for yield. So there's only really two or three ways you can get higher yield. One is to move down the credit spectrum and get some junky names,
mm-hmm.
or alternatively take currency risk. Take some currencies like Australian dollars or New Zealand dollars or South African rand, which has higher interest rates. Or alternatively, you start to use derivatives to make some bets. So you basically take a bet that something's going to happen, like the stock market's going to go up, or the dollar is not going to weaken, or you know oil price is going to trade in a certain range. You make these bets. Now, in itself, if the bet's correct, you get a higher rate of return. That's fine. The problem that I have with structured products is that I think many of the buyers don't necessarily understand the risks. And they're not really geared to make these types of bets. And to some extent, they become very dependent on the salesperson explaining the risks and the pros and cons. The problem is the salesperson is going to make between 2 and 4% up front. So his view of the merits of the product are purely personal. And so under those circumstances, he's not necessarily going to get the best advice. The other thing is these products are completely illiquid because they're done for a particular investor. So if you want to get rid of them, it's pretty difficult.
This is like the auction rate deal. This is
exactly
what happened where
exactly.
There's no market.
Exactly.
There's no market for this. Yeah.
Exactly. And the other issue about them, which makes them problematic, and this was illustrated horrifically with Lehman's, your bet might be 100% correct, but if anything happens to the issuer or the person providing the derivatives, the legal risks and the way the transaction unwinds can be terribly, terribly complicated. Mm-hmm. I'm involved in a small way with some of the matters to do with Lehman's in Hong Kong because they issued some notes called mini bonds there. And we are seeing a horrific scenario where really, really not terribly wealthy people in Hong Kong, and these are the Mr. and Mrs. Wongs who bought them, not understanding them necessarily, experiencing huge losses potentially because of things that they had no idea. And frankly, if you look objectively at the bet, leaving aside Lehman's, the bet is fine. They would actually have received a slightly higher rate of return and got their money back. But something that happened to Lehman, which some of them actually didn't even know who Lehman's was or why Lehman's was involved. And that becomes hugely problematic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to see, again, some problems. And Andrew, you'll remember, because you and I are of the same age, remember things like Orange County, Procter & Gamble,
oh, yeah.
all those things in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
And this is just a rerun of exactly that. And you remember why that happened was U.S. interest rates fell to 3%, which at the time, because they came from 15, 18%, seemed very low. People went and chased yield, either in junk bonds or in these structured products, with not always the result that they'd hoped for.
Right. I mean, Merrill did the same thing. Merrill was pushing back in the late 80s and the 90s, was pushing a lot of people towards... it wasn't structured notes, but they were CMOs, et cetera. This, you know, some type of derivation of another deal. And, you know, what happened was disastrous. And, you know, now I'm looking at some of these things saying, you know, why are the regulators still allowing these things to go through, especially when it comes to the smaller investor? And it's just the same thing over and over that, unfortunately, and I agree with you, that when you have a situation where you're retired, and you have, let's say, a certain amount of money. Maybe you have $500,000, $200,000. I don't care what the number is, $10 million. It doesn't matter. But your lifestyle requires a certain amount of interest to not invade the principal. What happens is that all of a sudden you're earning 6% on your CDs, then 4%, then 3%, then 2%. And now you're staring at this unknown situation because you look at the CDs today and a short-term CD is going to give you less than 1%, significantly less than 1%. And if you go out even further, even on a five-year deal, maybe you'll get 2.5%. And if you're used to living, let's say at, 4%, what's going to be to make up the difference? You don't want to invade your principal. So people are naturally led to two things, longer maturities or lower quality. And I think it was initially the intent of the Fed to do so, to bring people out from hibernation. But now it's become more than just an entrenchment. It's become just a natural process that the yields are so low because the demand just isn't there.
I think you're absolutely correct. I'll tell you a little funny story. A friend of mine's Japanese, and one day I saw him walking around with a check for 100 yen, which is about a dollar. I said, why are you carrying around this check for 100 yen? He said, that's what my mother received for interest. I said, what? How much is the amount? She said, the investment was for 1 million yen. And that was the interest for the entire year. And he said, very ruefully, the stamp on the envelope mailing the check costs more than 100 yen.
Yeah, it's crazy. No, it really is.
And it is crazy. And I think the other issue which you're pointing to is the Fed's policy of low interest rates. And I actually think what it's going to actually do is, in a country which requires saving, you're not really creating an incentive for saving. Because basically, if you save, and let's leave the stock market and other more risky investments out, if you just put your money in the bank, you're not going to get anything. And under those circumstances, the incentive for saving becomes lower. So people, as you say, either go for risk or they start to eat into principal. What most people forget that in Japan, it has a very large savings pool, but it's now falling because people have to save to live because they can't earn enough to actually sustain their lifestyle. And that's a huge issue going forward, which not many people have focused on.
But what happens there is, let's add to the fact that what we talked about earlier, which I think is the whole problem of kicking the can down the road and increasing the debt and giving it to the future generations to pay off. If future generations don't have the inheritance as much because the current generations ate into their principal over time, the fact is that it's going to be worse for them in the future. Now, each and every generation, I think, has probably said, oh, my kids aren't going to have what I have and all this, and this is the best generation. Wow, we finally have black and white TV and a radio with three channels on it, you know? And then the next generation says, wow, what this? Look at this. I got this computer with these two floppy disks, et cetera, you know, and an Atari. And you go up the generation, you know, what else can they invent? What else can they do for our life? But then somehow, magically, the next generation comes along and does just fine. Well, I'm going to say it now. I don't know how the next generation or two out are going to survive this mess. I really don't. There's no jobs. There's no jobs to speak of. I mean, there are some jobs, of course, but I mean, not in, if you're outside of the government, you know, you have to question your job security, your health insurance. I mean, I just got my health insurance for my family in a group plan is $1,700 US a month.
It's huge.
It's unbelievable. And that's not like the cream of the crop plans or anything. It's just a regular whatever plan, you know, Blue Cross Shield thing or whatever it is. I mean, it's unbelievable the cost that we have to spend on these kind of matters. I don't even talk about the fact that my water bill was $275 at my house last month.
And those bills aren't going to go down.
Right.
They're not going to go down over time because effectively if you look at the infrastructure that's required for health or utilities, it's massive. And particularly in many, many countries in the developed world, that infrastructure's actually been run down.
Yep.
And so that's going to need huge investment over the years, and the population will grow. So it's not going to go there. But you're absolutely correct about the future. I don't know whether you remember him. He was a Soviet prime minister for a little bit of time called Viktor Chernomyrdin. Mm-hmm. And he had the biggest foot-in-mouth disease of anybody I know. And once he was trying to explain his economic policy, and he said, you know, explaining his policies, we are going to live so that our children and our grandchildren will envy us.
Nice.
I think that might be the same in our generation, which is really sad.
Yeah, exactly. Let's finish up on the whole area of Asia, Australia, et cetera. You're in Australia. They've had a, I got to tell you something, a couple of missteps. Things were looking really good over there. I mean, it was almost very enviable how you didn't hit that recession and the mining companies were doing great. Your unemployment situation was great. Start to raise interest rates to make sure that things were cooling down. And, you know, continued on seeing nice employment gains, et cetera. And then someone got this grand idea to put the kibosh on the mining companies. I mean, stupid.
Well, I think fundamentally you've got to look at Australia in context. Now, the best way to describe it is we're a tiny cork on a big ocean. Mm-hmm. So we tend to bob along in the wake of everybody else. Now, the Australian recovery, you're quite correct, and the lack of recession was very, very prominent in the world. And I think the key thing about that was Australia is a very, very old world economy, which is really an agriculture and mining-based industry. And the fundamental thing was that China and India, which are big trading partners now, did quite okay. And Japan didn't collapse, but you know, Japan's never really grown either. So we maintained those three markets, which are key markets for us. And that actually helped us enormously. And that is what is underpinned the strength of the Australian economy. What really worries me is everybody worries about the out-of-control fiscal spending in various countries in the West. China's got up a huge problem because they've pumped their economy up something awful.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we were talking earlier about the stress test. Well, the Chinese did, I think, probably a fairer stress test in some respects. They found that of the $1.1 trillion that their banks, which are pretty much state-controlled, owned to local governments in China, they effectively expect to lose around about 25%. So effectively, we're talking about a loss in the vicinity of $250 billion. People have short memories. The Chinese banks had non-performing loans of like 30% 10 years ago. And we can see what's happening there is actually a microcosm of some of the problems. So what worries people in Australia and Asia is the prospects of a Chinese slowdown. And also the Chinese have some other problems, which is, as we talked earlier, their reserves, which is basically in US dollars and euros, are not worth as much as they used to be or won't be in the future. The other most worrying thing is the two major trading partners, which is the Eurobloc and North America, well, they're bankrupt, pretty much. So under those circumstances, I think at some stage in time, both China and India, and the signs are ominous, they're going to slow. And when they slow, what people forget, it's like a company with a lot of debt or high operating leverage. When China and India and emerging markets slow, they don't just slow in a very gradual glide. Right. They fall off the edge of a cliff.
Right.
And that's going to affect places like Australia and New Zealand because their exports will suffer. So I don't think the picture is gloomy, but I think the huge benefit we've had from China and India and the emerging market story is basically going to effectively flag over the next couple of years. The problem is nobody can have a very, very grand house in a bad neighborhood. And the problem for us is a bad neighborhood is the world.
Right. And that's, I think that sums up the whole point right now, that we've really done a lot. The party is over. And unfortunately, as gloomy as that sounds, you know, somebody's got to pay for it and clean it up. And that's where we're coming in right now to this whole thing. And the world is a much different place right now financially, than it was just a few years ago. And the question remains, how long can this party, after party, last? And is it going to be a situation where there's just a terrible and absolutely gnawing hangover for a long time? Or is it going to be a quick kind of plop, plop, fizz, fizz, and things are feeling a little bit better? We'll yet to be seeing that. I want to thank Satyajit Das. How's that better?
It's getting better. Getting
better. Traders, Guns, and Money. Pick up the copy over at Amazon.com. It's the knowns and unknowns in the dazzling world of derivatives. A really great read. And Das is an expert in the area of derivatives. The reason being that he worked in that area for many, many years. Has an insider's view that comes through very grandly in this book and gives you it in a storyline that gives you all the things that happen with from the first gentleman that comes in and has to sharpen his pencils for about 5 minutes or 6 minutes as a precursor to any meeting, to the discussion of how the various traders are talking and the investors are looking with blank stares saying, oh, this sounds good, and then the rest of the room realizing that they have no idea what's being talked about when it comes to the derivatives. I think that sums up some of the points. So check it out, Traders, Guns, and Money. It's a Prentice Hall piece, revised edition, just out over on Amazon. Das, thank you so much for joining us tonight, and we'll see you real soon. Hopefully when you get over to the wonderful world of the USA, if you ever get over here, we can have a little visit.
Thank you very much, Andrew. It's great to talk with you as always. Good luck.
All right, thanks. Now, don't you just love Das? I mean, I think he is wonderful. Seriously, I'm not kidding. First of all, he just has a really pleasant way about him. But also, he's just a incredible vat of raw and refined information all wrapped up into one. And I know that sounds kind of weird, but I got to tell you, he knows so much about these area of derivatives and so much about the area of what's happening in governments around the world that it makes it very, very clear. He's just one of those people that could really explain things in a simple, understandable way that is very much able to be imparted and at the same time, I think, absorbed. So that's some good news. We'll have him back again. I know a lot of you have written me before about him, and I do encourage you to pick up his book. Well, that's going to be wrapping up today. I think it's going to wrap it up. I don't think we have anything more on the agenda. We have lots of good guests coming up. I mentioned we have some people from the Investor's Business Daily coming up. We have Kevin DePue from Minionville coming up next week. Frank Curzio will be on shortly as well. We'll see if we can get Harry Dent on to figure out when this depression is actually coming. Maybe even Peter Schiff will get on one of these days. Some people have recommended we do that together, talk to both of those at the same time. We'll see. In the meantime, If you're interested in figuring out what to do with your money, you're paralyzed, don't know what to do, check out the 14-minute virtual tour over at thedisciplinedinvestor.com. It's a freebie to check out if you want us to manage your money. $50,000 if you like some of the things that we said. Oh, I forgot to mention, we got a couple of shorts. You know, I'll talk about that next week. The whole grain thing and the whole wheat thing. You know, we're looking at Kellogg's. We're looking at things like Panera Bread as short potentials. Actually, we shorted them here for our clients in the TDI Managed Growth. Small amount because this market will blow you out pretty quickly on the shorts. Very, very fast. So you got to be very careful, very nimble. But anyway, if you do want to check that out, go over to the website, thedisciplinedinvestor.com, and check out the 14-minute virtual tour. It's a little blue box that says click here and watch what we do, how we do it, why we do it, and maybe that's something that you want to do. We'll speak to you soon. Otherwise, thanks a lot for listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.